Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of the Proper Class Podcast. I'm Laura Checkley.
And I'm Hannah Chiswick.
And we are of course here to celebrate all things working class, because if we don't, who the bloody hell will, eh? No one. So love it or shove it, we're doing it.
Dear God. As always, we sit down with a working class hero to celebrate their life and achievements and discuss just how they got to where they are today. So, on that note, who are we celebrating this week, Laura?
Actually, I feel very lucky to have this week's guest with us, because let me tell you, this legend right here is what one might call comedy royalty. He is a stand-up comedian, a writer, a bloody good actor, and someone I'm lucky enough to call a friend. We are friends, aren't we? No, cool. Yep, no, colleague is fine. I'll take that.
Oh dear, how awkward. Actually, while we're on the subject of friendships, I could probably do without your 10-minute voice notes. Yeah, I have got other things to do in the world.
Oh, right.
Maybe we won't air our dirty linen in public. Who wants to think about our dirty linen?
Oh, Christ.
This week's guest.
Not with my arse.
Oh, my Lord. Back to it. This week's guest burst onto the comedy scene in the early 90s, winning the Time Out New Act of the Year with his musical character, Tommy Cockles. Shortly after that, he went on to tour the UK before joining forces with Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer on Big Night Out. After which, he went on to appear as a regular in Saturday Zoo, creating what Wikipedia calls, and we all know that's always correct, a groundbreaking rapping character called Ice Pick.
Actually, on the subject of Wikipedia, it says he even collaborated with the Transit Kings on their song The Lighthouse Keeper. I mean, I don't know that song, but it sounds pretty impressive. Blimey, is there anything he can't do? Answer is, well, bloody no. This man has a CV as long as your arm. So for fear of being here till the small hours, here are just a few of the shows you may know him from. Hit it, Han.
Deep breath. Right. Well, shows such as BBC Comedy Grass, which he co-wrote, The Alexei Sayle Show. He also co-wrote and starred in the cult hit mockumentary Life of Rock with Brian Penn.
Keep going.
He's been in shows such as The Windsors, Harry and Paul, Jumpers for Goalposts, Cradle to the Grave. Weren't you in that and all?
I was, yeah.
Boomers and Zapped.
We only get guests on that I've been in stuff with, just so I can
that's
talk about
me some more.
Turns out he's also a dab hand at the straighter stuff too, appearing in hit dramas like Death in Paradise, Pennyworth, Jonathan Creek and Skins, and not forgetting his brilliant film work too, Shakespeare in Love and Run, Fat Boy Run, to name but a few.
In 2012, he published his autobiography, Comedy and Error, They Really Were Marvellous Times, and also that same year presented his own series for Radio 4.
But no doubt you'll probably know this week's guest best for being part of the multi-award-winning sketch show that ruled British comedy throughout the 90s, and still, in my opinion, stands up today as one of the best sketch shows ever to have graced our screens. It is, of course, The Fast Show. And I've got to say, as a kid growing up admiring this man's work, it is nothing other than a bloody honour working and starring alongside him in our BBC sitcom, King Gary. Everyone, please give a warm, proper class podcast welcome to the comedy legend that is Simon Dow.
That was a mouthful.
I mean, it was knackering just reading everything you've done. I can't imagine what it was like doing it all.
Sounds like I've had a real career, doesn't it? When you actually, when you list it all.
But you have.
Yeah, I have. It's quite impressive when you hear it all
it's
like that.
Impressive.
And that's probably actually only half of it, because Like,
yeah, there's a few things missed out, and there's a few things in there where you think, why do they put that in there?
I know, it's hard to pick out what one might think was better than the other.
Yeah.
So how's it been going? How are you?
I'm all right. Yeah, good. Yeah, being a dad at home, me two kids, driving my son around to play football.
Yeah.
And I've done a few bits and bobs and doing some writing at the moment. I'm writing this thing about football, about kids' football.
Yeah.
And doing a few gigs.
Oh, you're gigging again? Or you're
going to
gig
again? Yeah, I did a few one-offs. It's like you say yeah to these gigs and then suddenly it's like, oh, I've got to do it on Wednesday. And I did in Manchester. I went up there. I did four characters. So I've got four outfits.
Four wigs.
Moustaches. I've got all this. I mean, just remembering everything. And I got there and it was like a sort of a little comedy club with a tiny stage and everyone eating pizzas. And I was like, why am I doing this? And then it was the night Barry Cryer died. Aww. And it was kind of poignant, you know, because I remember he came up to me in 1990 and went, Simon, oh, I love Tommy Cockles. I think it's great. And I thought he was talking to someone else. I turned around. I thought, who's he talking to? I kind of thought that's, you know, I was out there working on the boards, you know, when the great man passed away. So yeah, that was interesting.
Having spent so long, like, you know, gigging over the years, do you find it hard to keep still, like, and wait for the phone to ring? I know I do, like, having done the live circuit and then going, I now need just to sit back and
It's difficult doing those sort of gigs one off, doing four characters. You know, it was tiring, you know, I'm doing 20 minutes of each one. By the last one, you're like, I don't really want to do this one.
I know, you're not 20 anymore.
You just
want to
have a lean on the wall and sort of talk, where are you from? But, you know.
Most of the time, we start the podcast by asking our guest if they could take us back to somewhere that sort of really resonates with their working class past. Where would you take us to?
Okay, I was going to take you back in time to my mum's house, my nan's house in Kenilworth in the Midlands in Warwickshire, outside toilet. And she used to get the coal in every day. And she never stopped working, my mum's mum. We wouldn't lift a finger when we were there. Me and my brother, you know, and it was just, you know, it was all about food, really. It was all based around food. You have a chip pan on the hob, but you never changed the oil.
Never washed. Nan never washed her pans. Yeah.
And she'd make eggy fingers and homemade chips she'd make. And then Sunday they'd have roast beef and it would be like this really nice bit of beef, absolutely obliterated, just black. At the time, it seemed completely normal. You're just eating charcoal.
Yeah.
All the veggie out of the garden, but again, boiled away to nothing.
No flavour, yeah.
And then homemade puddings like egg custard and jam roly-poly. She'd make her own jam and all that stuff. And, you know, we'd go there every weekend or every other weekend. We'd go up there and they had a thing where you pump the water out of the yard and got a bucket of water and they're the outside toilet and the heating. They didn't have central heating.
So when you said, oh, she used to go and get the coal, what would it be based out in the back garden?
No,
she'd have
a bunker and the coal man comes and drops the coal in and they go like that with the coal scuttle and they throw it in the thing. I mean, obviously we'd do it if we were there, we'd help, but we wouldn't help actually, but they'd try and make us help. But that was life and she'd scrub the step as well.
Yeah, my nan used to scrub the step. That was a thing, wasn't it?
I actually saw a man, something about it was really heartbreaking. I was walking from King's Cross down to Angel and there was a guy doing his doorstep, scrubbing his doorstep and sweeping out the front, like in King's Cross.
That's weird.
And it was just something about it. And he was an old fella.
Oh. Dirty in half hour.
I just thought, like, it was all this traffic coming along and it was filthy. It was like a main road, but he was still doing his step that obviously he'd seen.
But that's a working class pride, isn't it? I think.
Absolutely.
His kingdom.
I grew up in a very clean household because having clean clothes, having clean things meant, I think we thought, meant wealth. Like if you looked well turned out, no one would know you ain't actually got any money. But yeah, it's interesting that. Talk to me about the outside toilet. I had a mate who still had one, but we didn't. I didn't grow up with an outside loo. Did you not shit yourself going out in the night?
I used to like it because it was a bit weird out there. But it was freezing cold.
Yeah.
You wouldn't go out and hang out in there. You'd probably go out there not for a number two, just for a number one. Sometimes you have a number two if you're trying to get away from your family, you know. But always cobwebs and sort of old newspapers. Quite spacious, though, but freezing cold when you sat down.
Yeah, you wouldn't go out there unless it was necessary, would you?
Not
my neighbour had an outside loo when I was growing up.
Yeah,
she didn't have any inside loo.
Yeah, my mum's friend did. So when we went round there, I used to experience it. But I'd never go down there in the night. I found it terrifying.
Surely no one's
people
got
don't
an
look out. They don't look after their outside loos as much. I found.
sort of like they just didn't clean it as much, and like you said, cobwebs, no, and yeah, it was just like sort of left, wouldn't it?
She just wouldn't go out and scrub that. No, you're quite right. She'd probably sort of be a little less.
Yeah.
But I feel also it was a lot of lights being turned off and all that. Yeah. It's blazing all on that. The whole house is blazing. It's like, turn all the. I do that now. I turn all the lights on.
Yeah, I go around turning lights on.
My missus never does it.
Yeah.
God, you tell
fuel prices.
Turning other people's lights off for them. So, did you grow up in London, though? So, where did you
I grew up in London, yeah. But it was quite a weird one for me because my mum was working class and my dad was sort of middle class. I think he'd like to have been posher than he really was. But his dad was just a builder who sent his kids to public school,
right.
Private school.
Oh, wow.
So when you find when you start examining it, I used to be obsessed with it all because I was a big fan of the Jam. And I mean, I don't think people realise how much we talked about class then. When we were young, we were working class and being posh was a sort of, he's posh. And it was a big sort of problem, wasn't it? You know,
yeah,
so
yeah.
I was a bit of a Mockney. When I went to my secondary school, I was a bit of a Mockney, you know, because I didn't want to get bashed up. And I do all the comedy routines too.
Right.
But our house was a bit strange because you had these two completely different sort of upbringings. You know, my mum and my dad, totally different. She was a nurse. She was going to go to university and they said, no, you've got to get a job. We've got no money, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So she just moved to London and married someone. That's what you did then.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether you really got on with them. And then you toughed it out for 10 years, then got divorced, you know.
Where were you in London?
Blackheath.
Oh, Blackheath. Yeah. Blackheath's very nice now, and it's
lovely. Beautiful.
Beautiful.
Beautiful, yeah.
I grew up in Greenwich. I was in Westcombe Park.
I know.
Which is, again, quite posh now, isn't it?
It wasn't, though. So when I say that, people go, oh, you grew up in Greenwich. But my parents moved there in the 70s because it was like the cheapest place in London to live. Greenwich was. Now you couldn't buy a shed in Greenwich. No. I mean, it's so expensive.
It's like East Greenwich and West Greenwich as well. Yeah. East Greenwich was rough. But, yeah, but I lived all around there, Deptford, New Cross, you know, all around South East London.
And how did you go to school there? How was school for you?
Yeah, I had a nice little primary school. We used to skip along to the primary school, and then I went to Thomas Tallis, which was...
Oh, my God!
So did I.
Oh, here we go!
God! That's amazing!
I can't believe it.
Yeah, that's when it all kicked off. My parents broke up, and that sort of addiction kicked off there at Thomas Tallis.
What, like 15? Yeah,
when I was 15, 16.
It's just blowing my mind. Because obviously that's the same as me, Ferrier, all of that stuff. I mean, now I drive past the day. I mean, it's...
They've levelled it.
It's really, like, posh, all these new builds.
They've painted
it
all, yeah.
But it was really rough. I always say that the only thing our school was famous for, well, obviously is you, Summer, but I didn't know that. And the shoe bomber.
The shoe bomber, I'm always looking up going, famous, and it goes, Robert, the shoe bomber. That's it. Nothing about me in there. It's a great old boy, isn't it? Like Dulwich College, they say sort of, oh, well, Rudyard Kipling, you know, who's your old boy at Thomas Tallis? The shoe bomber. I mean, they said it all.
Oh, yeah, and Owen Simon Day is also, you know. I know you said, obviously, you went off the rails when your parents split up and stuff, but were you academic at all
at all. No, I was dyslexic.
Really? Yeah.
All the other things that went with attention deficit disorder, which I just discovered through my son, having him diagnosed. So then I just kind of just got jobs. And it was there I kind of spent a lot of time working class people. I didn't really knock around with my sort of lot. They were going to university. I then would get jobs and knock around, went down the pub and played pool, light and bitter, and like, you know, rap. That's where I kind of got my sort of love of that sort of culture, and I think where I got the experience to do those characters, you know, because I just used to spend so much time in the pub.
Yeah.
I've got a love of those sort of characters, you know. It's basically the people who think on their feet, you know. and I'd get different jobs and they'd be like, oh, you know, your parents are broken up, and they'd say, come join the dance team and all that. Some of them sort of got a whiff that things weren't... Because sometimes I was homeless for a bit, you know, in between... And it just made me laugh. Those sort of people I found to be more fun. You know, they're more sort of generous, more fun, more sort of... And
colourful, aren't they?
Colourful, more colourful,
just
yeah.
Like, yeah.
And a lot less judgment, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, that might be unfair, but that's what we always speak about, isn't it? People just taking people as they are and going, all right,
then. Yeah, exactly,
And totally flawed.
Yeah.
All at the same time, you know, like...
Oh, God, yeah.
When did your love of comedy start then, Si? Was it at school? Was it because, you know, a lot of people, comedians, start because they're unpopular, being bullied, or there's something
going on that they're hiding behind. I had that, and then I had... The only time me and my dad got on was watching comedy. That was, yeah, that we didn't, we had nothing in common. And he was like, sit still, be quiet, we, you know, you're mad. Because he was academic and very sort of strict. And so, yeah, and I just grew up at the right time, you know, Malcolm and Wise and all those incredible sitcoms, you know, Steptoe and Son and Likely Lads and Porridge, The Only Fools and Horses. They were kind of masterpieces, you know, To a Devil's Due Part. And just, they were all working class stories, weren't they? Just ordinary working class life, just incredibly well acted and brilliantly scripted and very believable, you know, and all those, and like you said, and like characters like Only Fools and Horses, you know, characters like Trigger. I mean, you couldn't really describe that.
No.
And if you've worked on the council, you go in pubs and you get those people like that. Who always call you by the wrong name or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the genius of that show. I don't think he gets enough credit, really, the guy that wrote that, because he wrote all that on his own. I mean, all the other ones were duos, weren't they, the other writers?
Yeah.
Dick Clement and Ian Lefrenet. And so, yeah, so I just loved that sort of... Yeah, sort of, I don't know, God knows why, I just thought it was, like I said, amazing... It was an amazing culture and a high art, you know, and proper art.
And so when did you, like, stand up and start doing it yourself? When did you think, right, OK, I've got an idea for this, I'm going to do a gig or I'm going to... What happened?
I'd sort of fallen out. I was working with a mate and he had his own gardening firm and it wasn't really working out and I was a bit like, what am I going to do? And then a mate of mine, he had a shop selling fireplaces, you know, and... Jim and Bob, Vic and Bob, had moved to London. They lived above it. They worked above it.
Next door to my house, I've just got to say. This is really blowing my mind. where they worked and wrote was the top of my road, next to my house.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
this is literally so...
Halcyon, what's it called?
Yeah, they were in that alleyway by the station and I live just around the corner.
Oh, I never knew that.
Yeah.
So he said, you're funny, you should write something, blah, blah. And I just wrote a set with him and he was... Because I, you know, I did struggle with writing on my own and he forced me to write it and bought the wigs and... Made sure I followed up and practiced it.
How amazing.
Wow.
Did a gig, and Jim and Bob were judging it, talent night, and they went, smart, you know, you can come on tour with us. And I went on tour with them. We didn't do any circuit gigs.
Bloody hell.
And that was terrifying. You know, I used to die most nights. You know, most nights you'd die, but after that, I wasn't really scared of anything, you know.
I bet.
Wow.
1,000 people were all going, get off, you cockney twat. And all that, you know. Because I did so many cockles mainly.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was really quick. To have that was just luck. I mean, for them to come and move to London, it's kind of weird, isn't it? Because they're from Darlington on Middlesbrough.
Yeah.
And they moved to South East London.
They were always together. They weren't like separate, met on the circuit.
No, Jim did his own show. He was at Goldsmiths and it was like 3.5 hours long and it had the toff in it. And a bloke would come on and just smoke a pipe and then the man with the ladder. And it was like one of those sort of prog rock albums. And then Bob used to come along and heckle.
He
said, you're funny, you know. And then Bob got involved and Bob was very instrumental. And he cut it down, got rid of people. And, you know, it doesn't really work like this. And he was quite professional on that side of it. He's a bit more, very shrewd. It wasn't long after that he got the TV show, you know.
How did you find that, like, you've sort of gone from nothing to, like, playing on like a big stage, really, for a novice.
Yeah,
you know, did that sort of add to all the stuff when you had all the stuff you had going on with your addiction, all that? Do you feel like that just sort of fueled it?
I just felt cocky all the time. It cheered me up, really. Because my addiction then was fruit machines, so I didn't really have any kind of other big problems at the time. But before, when you're earning 100 quid a week, fruit machines are a really bad problem because you're just losing all your money.
Yeah, sure.
Do you know what I mean? Once you start earning proper money, I just stopped playing them because it was kind of like, what's the point?
There's nothing it can give you in a way. Yeah,
there's no jeopardy, is there?
No.
In between working with them, suddenly I was just gigging again, and that can get you down a bit, you know, when you're just going around doing gigs.
Yeah.
And then luckily the VAR show come along, so...
So how soon after did the Far Show come, after all that gigging then and with Vic and Bob and stuff?
Yeah, pretty quick, because they used to come and watch Jim and Bob, and Charlie was involved with Jim and Bob and Paul. Charlie used to produce the shows and, you know, generally sort of boss them around, you know. And Paul said, yeah, we're going to do a show one day, Mr. Day, you're going to get you in it for characters, be funny. You know, I was like sort of in awe of him at that time, obviously, as you would be. And yeah, and it was made for me, really, because it was just short characters. They said, write whatever you want and we'll try and put it in, if it, you know. And it was all those short sketches, because I don't think I could, because I've been thinking about it, because people go, oh, why don't you write like a drama? And why? I struggle to sit down for that length of time and do it. Yeah, so for me, it was perfect. You know, oh, a bloke in a pub playing a machine and then...
But in the 90s particularly, and 80s, I think, a sketch scene was so huge, wasn't it? Because, you know, I grew up watching it. I think it's somewhat died out now a bit, isn't it, the sketch scene? But, I mean, it's still happening, but it's not as popular. It was really big in the 90s with French and Saunders, all of you, like, Farshow, all of you.
Sketch shows, you just don't know. Yeah. Sketch show, yeah.
Big Train, exactly.
Well, they've obviously put money, when something's successful, they put money into it, don't they? And they try and recreate that.
Yeah.
It's like after The Office, there were loads of sort of...
Mockumentary type.
Sort of
quite,
yeah.
Almost exactly the same one, though.
But not as good, obviously. But they, I don't know why the BBC, they always do that, TV companies, you know, they have a hit show and they go, well, now we're going to make loads of shows like that one.
Yeah, it happens.
Well, no, it's a hit because no one had ever seen it yet. So, obviously, we've like massively like put that all into a short amount of time, but you've gone from not that long ago, perhaps, sofa surfing, being a bit homeless, but suddenly you're in like the biggest hit, comedy hit on TV. Was that, how was that, suddenly people knowing who you were and like, did it completely change your life?
Well, it's not first, really. No, I was kind of carried on just being me, and I didn't buy a house or anything for a long time. I suddenly sort of looked round and everyone had bought big houses, and I was like, you're still living in a rented flat and going out in pubs in Greenwich with Malcolm Harder, you know. And I'm like, this is not good. Then I met the missus, you know.
Yeah.
And she, thank God, said, well, you know, get rid of him. That's what, you know, get rid of him.
Yeah.
And we bought a place eventually. Well, I had a flat in Brighton, actually, that I bought. But yeah, it, I don't know, it just sort of happened. And when it was happening, it just seemed sort of normal. I mean, you do some days, you sort of pinch yourself and just think, this is crazy, you know. But it was sort of, it just sort of went on, you know. It unfolded.
And how did your, like, was your dad alive at that time? Did he see all of that happen?
He was.
How did he change his mind about...
Well, the only thing he really liked, my dad, was when I went on Celebrity Mastermind and I won that.
Oh, right, okay.
What was your subject?
Sopranos.
Oh, right.
Amazing.
Nice.
What a brilliant subject.
And, did you win?
Because he could get that, you see. He'd come and see me. But I won, but only by default, because Sophie Grigson and Steve Harley from Cockney Rebel, they could have beaten me, but every time we got a question they didn't know, they went, oh, I know this one. If you just go past...
Wasted loads of time.
You just get another question. It's so obvious. Plus, if you've done stand-up, I can see they're really nervous.
Yeah.
But when you've done stand-up, doing that, it's just nothing's nerve-wracking, is it?
No, nothing is nerve-wracking. Well,
that's the best thing about it. Well,
I would worry about looking like an idiot, but, you know, that's me standard anyway. But
he loved that. He rang me up. I told him what he was on, and he rang me up. Well, yeah, he loved that. Because he came to see me just after I started, and it was typical, you know, I came off stage, it was a student gig, wasn't very good. And he went, no, he said, you said you didn't swear. You know, and he had a sort of go at me for swearing. And I was like, oh, what have I got to do to impress this bloke?
Yeah.
You know, but that's your standard comics, parents. Most comics don't have like a relationship with their parents, do they? Because it's quite an odd thing to want to do, isn't it, really? Love me.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare.
PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So now, obviously, you know, you're comfortable,
yeah.
Presumably. You've got your kids and whatever. How
having
that working class kind of upbringing, I know you had a lot of success quite early on and stuff, but, you know, would you, and I know you can look around and go, you're looking at it from a privileged point of view now, do you still find yourself very much connected to your working class roots?
I don't really even think about it. You know, I mean, I don't think about it in that way, you know, because I didn't come from that sort of working class thing with all the family around the piano and, do you know what I mean, and aunts and uncles. Yeah. It was never really like that. It was always quite strange because, like I say, with my mum being working class and my dad, you know, being sort of lower middle class, whatever. I see all the different classes there are in England. I don't really think about it. I do in terms of work. There's not nearly as much stuff as there used to be on telly or as much good stuff on the radio or TV from working class writers.
Yeah.
We didn't go to the right university. I don't really believe that. And I think you can still have a perfectly good career without going to Cambridge. But still, I think it there was a time when it was a real seam, a rich seam of amazing sort of art, wasn't it? And it seems to have gone, really.
Do you think it's gone? That collaboration between, like, the live scene, whether that was, like, even further back in, like, the working men's clubs, and then the comedy circuit, and I know they're different things, and then sort of people really honing their craft, trying stuff out, so by the time it hit the telly, it was in really good shape, it's in really good nick. People had found their characters like you had, that they knew and they worked and they were good at what they did, and people really had to do that for a while for anyone to notice them, and it just doesn't have that live part. I think, obviously I'm not a comedian, but that live part just doesn't exist. And I think COVID has knocked the end of that off, but there's just not as many live... Even when you started, Laura, I feel like people were gigging a lot more than they do now.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell, isn't it, now, because of COVID and stuff. But I think there is a live circuit now. I just think it's shifted and it's not sustainable for working class people.
That's,
I know,
part of it as well,
certainly,
isn't it?
You know, like talking about it being really prevalent in the 90s and the 80s, I think that the industry was quite saturated with working class, even with actors, Julie Walters and all of them lot, you know.
Yeah.
And watching that as a kid, I thought there's a place for me. And then when I got onto the comedy circuit in the late, was it 2009 or whatever, it's suddenly like really, really middle class. Not suddenly, but for me it was like there's not a place for me, and I'm being told I'm really coarse, and actually I was quite old fashioned in my comedy, but it's just because we both spoke with a working class accent. So I found like it shifted, and I do think there is a live scene now, but I do think it's harder for working class to see themselves getting in, because it's like it feels like a bit of a closed shop now.
You don't get many working class sitcoms anymore, do you?
No.
I mean, King Gary was one, but you don't really. But there was a big difference. The thing was, it interested me was all those things, Steptoe and Son, The Likely Lads and Porridge and Dad's Army, how good they were. But you compare them to the programmes that were on with the people like the comedians, and they were terrible. Those shows with people just coming on and telling the same jokes. I mean, they were just, you know, the comedy did have to change. The alternative comedy did do that. It made it more intelligent and, you know, much less sexist and sort of repetitive. But I don't know. It's a funny time, really, because it seems to be expensive comedy, and you don't know whether something's going to be a hit.
Yeah.
So they don't put money into it. They're worried. They'd rather put money into some sort of kid who keeps pigs and makes his own bacon, you know, sort of charming. Charlie, whatever, and then they do a cookbook and, you know, no, I'm serious, and, yeah, and they know what they're going to get. 2 million viewers for that, and we'll sell the cookbook. And
it's not about longevity anymore, is it? It's about sort of smash and grab a bit, and I can make money here really, really quickly. Did you want to ask something?
Well, I was just going to say, like, so you do the Four Show, and then obviously, but what was there a job that you did or an opportunity that came along that you felt like really pushed you outside your comfort zone? It was like a completely different experience from like being on the comedy.
The only thing that I did that was really outside my comfort zone was when I did this play. This was a few years back, 4 or 5 years ago. It was summer, and I got offered this play for sort of like no money. It didn't matter. It was a really tiny theatre.
Welcome to the theatre.
It was called Waiting for Godot, right? And it was about two actors who were in the dressing room waiting to see whether they're going to go on stage.
Oh, it's quite clever. That sounds brilliant.
It was brilliant, and it was very clever. And I did a normal thing. The guy sort of chose me, you know. He was a working class guy. He was from Lambda. He was sort of from Midlands. I did my normal thing. I didn't learn it, you know. I thought, well, I'll learn it in the 2 weeks before we start the play, you know.
Simon.
So I get there, and like they're all like the other kid. There's just one other guy in it, and he's completely off the page, you know. Kid. And it's all full of slapstick. It had lines where I'd say a line, then the ironing board would fall down, and then he'd jump over that and say this. And I just got really, because I hadn't learned it, I then went the wrong way and started going, oh, I'm really sorry, I should have learnt this. And then he started rehearsing for a week of walking around duck ponds and all that and saying, you're by the duck pond, there's something you really want to say to someone, but you can't say it, which I've never done.
No, that's not for you, is it?
No, it's not. And I was thinking, can't I learn the script? Because, you know.
We should learn it and do it, please.
By press night, we were all right. Let's just say that. But it was good. It was good.
How did you find the theatre world?
It was tiny, so it was nice. And I've done the Lady Killers before.
Right. Yeah.
That was really good fun. But I just didn't have enough to keep me interested. See, it's a bit like doing it in your sleep. And in general, if you've done stand-up, it's very hard to do theatre. You get bored, you know.
Yeah. The idea for me, I always did, because I started in theatre, but the idea of doing a long run to me seemed like hell.
You never liked that, though,
never
did you?
Liked it, because
I remember, like, we did a lot of shows together, didn't we? And you'd always say to me after the first night, oh, that's the best bit done. And not really the first night. You loved rehearsing, didn't you? And
I like playing.
Yeah.
And you can't play once it's set and done. There's a bit of element of playing, but it's going on and saying the same thing for a year just doesn't interest me.
I don't know how they do it.
No. And even like doing a run, when you toured, like with your characters, I'm sure at some point you're like, I'm a bit done with them now. I'm done with those characters. Ones now.
The thing is, you can ad lib then. I can do it all.
Make
up your
Well, exactly, yeah.
But
yeah.
Because I remember, you know. I wanted to change something once. They were like, no, you can't break the fourth wall and all that stuff.
Can I tell a joke here? No, Simon. It's the end of the first act. You can't.
Something we talk about a lot, I feel like I'm a bit of a tangent, but obviously you say you've got two kids.
Yeah.
Do you think their upbringing has been quite different to yours because of what you've done and what that's been able to sort of... opportunities you've been able to offer them?
I think, I'll tell you what, more I've noticed with them is that they've not had, not been negative, but they've not had the boredom, I think, which is bad. And I think that's bad for creativity. They're never bored. So they never had that thing of just sitting in a car for 2 hours without anything.
Using imagination.
Using your imagination.
Yeah.
They're constantly, the endorphins, they're constantly on a phone or an iPad or the telly. You know, when they watch telly, they're like, fast forward it, you know. So... Yeah, and also I made a point of not being like my parents. My parents were really like, no, you're going to learn the value of money and, you know, you go on a school journey, it would be £2 spending money and you go on the coach and all the kids off the estates would all have like 25 quid and you'd have 2 quid.
Yeah.
And they'd be like, why have you only got 2 quid? And I'd think, why have I only got 2 quid? So I would be probably a bit over-generous with them as well. I think, you know, I certainly haven't taught them the value of money. Mind you, my parents didn't teach me it either. I was still the same.
The £2 didn't work for you anyway.
So. You just want to spend money.
I think as soon as you have to get a job, you learn it very quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you, you still, to me, have such a working class accent still, whatever that means, very London,
London
accent. You do, like when I met you, oh, he's working class. Like, I would never have guessed that your dad might have been, I don't know, middle class, have people ever made assumptions with you, like, because I know it's happened with my mates, it's happened with me, like assumptions on how you talk, like if you do come across, I don't know, a middle class kind of person that you're working with, or anyone, has anyone ever made assumptions with just how you talk that you're going to be a certain way?
Yeah, I imagine so, yeah. I think people do that all the time, don't they? I don't know. I think, you know, one of the assumptions is that I'm, that's all I do, sort of blokey working class. That's what voiceovers I ever get.
Yeah.
You can voice a bloke going, oi.
Yeah.
Drop that, put that back. You kind of think, you know, I'm capable of so much more, darling.
I know. No, it's true, though.
But you do get on, you know, that is my character, sort of blokey.
Do you think as well there's a part of the audience, people that want to see that from you as well? Like they'd almost be disappointed if you come on and really sort of playing a posh, toffee-nosed character.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at my characters, the ones that were like that aren't nearly as popular as the... Mm. Like, when I do those birthday things, the video birthdays, it is 98% Dave Angel.
People ask for that all the time.
98% Dave Angel, and you kind of think, I should have done a sitcom with him a long time ago.
I moan all the time going, I only get this, I only get working class stuff. But if I'm really honest, they are the characters that interest me the most.
Yeah.
You know, like I do want to play other characters, of course, but I lean beautifully into them and
it's hard. You know who they are as well. Yeah. I remember you saying about King Gary and people saying to you, like, God, they're quite extreme, those characters. Like, the people who don't live, and you were like, not at all, because they're the people that we know. I mean, yeah, there's the heightened elements to them, but they're not people that we've not met. I know those people. No, you know those people.
People that ask that question just don't come from our world, and that's they'll never get it.
They don't understand it. Well, they say Essex people, don't they?
Essex.
Their idea of anyone working class. Sorry, they say Essex. That was a TV reviewer, said that.
What?
It was Essex.
So. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it wasn't at all King Gary. Yeah, it wasn't at all. So after the Farce show, was it hard, like, after that sort of, I don't know, huge success? Do you think, I've had my moment now? That was my moment.
At times you think that, and other times you think, maybe that's it, you know? And that was your big thing. Because I've still done the characters. I've always enjoyed doing them live. And, you know, I could get a fairly decent living out of doing them live. Provided you get someone to come along and see it. But, that's changed, obviously. You know, there was a time when I used to sort of, when it was really popular. But, yeah, you know, I remember I met someone. Who was it? I met that guy who did The Wire.
Dominic...
The West.
Yeah, Dominic West.
You only get one show. It was just totally rubbish, because he's had about 8.
He's had about 20, yeah.
Yeah, so he's been Fred West. So... You know, I think often that is the case, isn't it? If you look at people's careers, most people's careers, they have one big hit. And you meet people and they say, what are you doing now? You know, and you just spend about half an hour telling them about Brian Pern and King Gary and all that. And then they go, the Farce show is brilliant. I had a great one the other day. I had a woman say, my husband met you on a plane when you were at the height of your career.
Oh, my God.
She had no idea what she'd said.
Not meant with any manners or rudeness.
And I was like, really good, hey, like that. Spilt, you know.
Oh, mate.
Old egg yolk on the shirt.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So, you know, you said you can't concentrate on anything for very long. I mean, I've worked with you. You can. How did you manage to write your book?
The book was easy because I knew all the stories.
Right.
And I told all the stories so many times.
Right.
As comedy stories, I never really had to sit and think, you know, because I knew what, you know, it's a good story, you know, you got the books to win there. And.
Can I ask you about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I know Hannah, I told Hannah about it and you were like, oh, what?
Yeah. No, it was.
How old were you when you went in?
19.
What was it?
I was homeless and I was kind of nuts. I wasn't on drugs. I used to just watch people play fruit machines and I would steal money and play fruit machines. I was literally obsessed with them. And I'd get caught, nick a Fred Perry, and I'd get caught and go to the police station. And then I'd just go and nick something else from another shop or car. And I did it once, twice in 1 week, and the magistrate said, well, you were up before me last week. I'm going to remind you in custody. Because I was home. I didn't have a fix to boat. They just remind you in custody.
Right.
So I was on remand for 3 months. But again, that was kind of a bit like, oh, this is a weird, funny adventure.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? I did at it a bit like that.
Wow.
At times, and other times, you were like, God, what's going on here? You know, how did this happen? But things were so bad in my real life that it wasn't that bad. Does that sound?
Yeah, of course.
I was just sort of ashamed of myself all the time. You know, everyone's doing well, they're all at university, what are you doing? You've got no job, you just nick money and play fruit machines, you've got holes in your socks, you know. So some of it was horrific and some of it was boring, and that is prison really. It's boring most of the time, but it was a year. So
you did a year.
A year in total.
Did it? Do you feel like it changed you?
It taught me how to make a bed.
I better go.
It did make me realise how lucky I was, and you don't want to be coming back in here.
No. Yeah.
And there's kids here who've been abused and from children's homes, and they're horrendous. Horrific. Stories. But that part of it, you know, because people say, "Oh, you're a character comedian," you know, it's all about listening for me. Like if I meet a character, I'll just get them talking, you know, as much as possible.
Yeah.
And in there, you get a cellmate, and you be interesting. And like, you just get him to tell the story, you know.
My God!
But it wasn't like, you know, Scum. It wasn't. It was some violent. I had a few fights in there because I knew I had to have a couple, otherwise, I'd get picked on. But the longer you're in there, the more you become like Fletch, you know, because after you've been in there 5 months, you're like an old lag, aren't you? And there are people coming in there all nervous, and you're like, all right, mate, you know, whatever. I mean, luckily I got into comedy.
So, yeah, because I was going to say, like, what did you do for work when you got out? Because presumably...
I think mentally I was obviously very damaged by it, but I didn't feel it. I just sort of came out and went, oh, you know, I'm great, I'm all right. I just got some muck jobs, what would be termed muck jobs. I had a nice little council flat by the river and played pool.
Probably like £1 million that flat
is.
Now.
It is!
Yeah, I bet.
I gave it back to the council and I just used to sort of do jobs.
Yeah.
I was getting older, 25, 26, 27, and I'm like, well, you know, what? But still thinking, what are you going to do, you know? And then suddenly, 29, it all sort of happened that quickly. So it's a crazy story, really.
So you were 29 when you met Vic and Bob?
29, yeah. No, up to that point, I'd never had a penny. Simon. I'd never had more than sort of 100 quid.
And how was having money? How did that...
I spent it a lot. I was like, you do one or the other, don't you? Make it rain! I was it. I was a bit like a rapper. I used to make it rain quite a lot, yeah, in the pub. You know, as much as you can make it rain in the pub, buying crisps for everyone.
So listen, Si, we're coming to the end of our celebration of you. So just at the end of our show, we always like to ask our guests if they'd like to celebrate anyone today, a working class hero that they would like to celebrate. Who would that be for you today?
I was going to do a sort of a serious one. I'm going to do a silly one. And this is my grocer, John, right? He's my age and he's got a fruit and veg shop in Dollis Hill. And he started working on there when he was 12. He used to work on Saturday mornings when he was 12. And then I think he started working three days a week when he was 13 or something. And he's worked there from the age of 17, 7 days a week. Or he has one day off now, up at the market, 4 o'clock.
Oh, my God.
And, like, it's just the stories he tells. And he said there used to be 17 different fruit and veg shops from between the two stations, and now there's just one, just his left.
He's still standing.
And, he's still standing. The stories he comes out with the whole time. But it's that obsessive desire. He is a workaholic.
Yeah.
You're taking away from that environment. He literally doesn't know what to do. In fact, he got ill. He went on holiday and he got really ill. He didn't really know. His body sort of shut down. But he's great. He always come up with his quotes and he goes, you know, it's global warming, Simon. It's global warming. I've been here about 40 years and weather ain't changed much. And a lot of stuff like that. He's always trying to talk to you just as you're leaving. You know, you're just...
Oh, God, yeah.
You're going to watch the fight on Saturday and you're like... But, you know, I think, to me, you should do documentary about people like that. But they did one on the markets, didn't they? They did Smithfield and they did the food. They were brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
They're so strange, those people. That funny bloke just sold asparagus. He had an old sort of wooden hand-painted asparagus thing. He's about 90.
And that's what he's done for his whole life.
It's amazing that they
get up in the middle of the night to go and sell asparagus. That
and then you find out they're all divorced, aren't they? Most of them got divorced.
Yeah, I mean, because a lot of markets now are your sort of indoor, sort of borough posh markets, the big lumps of cheese, isn't it? And like, but when you see those real old market stalls or the odd little thing standing, it's so rich, the stories in there. What's the greengrocer's name? What's his name?
John. His name is
John.
John, yeah.
Do you know his surname?
He wouldn't hate that.
John the Greengrocer.
Let's just call him John the Greengrocer. He'd hate
it if I told him his second name. It's not O'Farrell, it's the Butchers. And I just say John. Because he wouldn't like to be. He'd go, he's talking to me about me for. But yeah, he's funny.
Thank you so much. I can't believe we went to the same school. That's glitch.
Thomas Tallis.
Thomas Tallis rules, eh?
Thank you very much for inviting me. And it's a very interesting subject.
Thank you, Si. Thanks so much for coming on. And like I said, like you're a massive, massive comedy legend and hero. Oh, yes, and I know you don't want to hear it, but it's very, very true. And thanks for coming on. Really appreciate it, mate.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Oh my God, I'm actually still a bit blown away that I feel like me and Simon might potentially have lived parallel lives.
I did not know that.
The same bloody school. He was like working in the studio at the end of my road. I mean,
all those years apart and that poor school is still the same.
Oh, listen, you know, it had its many good parts as well. But
well,
yes.
Yeah, I mean, it turned out you, Simon, and the shoe bomber. So.
I'm not sure the school can take me as too much credit, but Simon certainly.
Do you know what's lovely about doing this show for me, like personally, is that, you know, I'm getting to talk to friends just on a different level. I did not know he'd been in Borstal. I did not know that.
That's amazing, isn't it? I mean, there's a turnaround of a life.
Yeah.
And do you know what it makes me think about a lot of the time? I mean, this is a little bit of a tangent, I have to say, but just how mainstream education fails so many brilliant, talented, amazing people.
Yeah.
And I just think that's a reminder to, I wish someone had told me that when I was younger and not quite fit in all those boxes. Any listeners out there who might still be going through that process, you know, there's always and means to get where you want to get to, isn't there? Some of the greatest people didn't.
Yeah,
you know.
you're absolutely right. You're so good at a wrap up.
Am I?
Yeah.
I'm terrible at a wrap though.
Oh my God. Right. Well, that's it for this week. Join us next week for a brand new guest. Are you excited, Hannah Chiswick?
I was until you did that.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for joining us. And remember, go on, you say it.
Keep it classy.
Great. Should have seen her face when she did that.
Classy.
The Proper Class podcast is produced by Michelle Farr-Scott for Rangaby Productions, edited by James Torrance, with music by Tommy Music. Just to let you know, folks, the Proper Class podcast is now going weekly. And whilst I've got you here, please don't forget to like and subscribe. Spread the word. Tell your friends, neighbours, whoever will listen. We've also got an Instagram page. Ooh, get us. And you can follow all the news and goss at the Proper Class podcast. And if you haven't nodded off yet, we've also gone and got ourselves an official email. So do get in touch. The email is properclasspodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, folks. And remember, keep it classy.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.